your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium.
Well, welcome once and iodine, more. And thorium, and thulium, and I'm Joe Schwartz. I direct McGill University's Office for Science and Society, and we chat every week at this time and discuss some of the latest happenings in the world of science, challenge you with some interesting questions, and bring you up to date on some of my thoughts about what is happening out there. To get started, I'm going to throw my questions out at you, and I'll do two at a time so that you guys have something to work with. The first one deals with a startup chemical company that is going to use a gene that they isolate from bananas to produce one of the most important chemicals in the world. This chemical will be produced from carbon dioxide. But in order to do that, you need this gene from bananas. So the question is, what does that gene and bananas code for that is so important for this company? Because they're going to use that gene to produce a very important chemical. So what does that gene in bananas code for? All right, that's one question. And the next one. What modern device uses the same principle as the Pepper's Ghost effect that I'm sure many of you have seen in Disney's Haunted House, where you go through this large ballroom, as it were, and you see the dancing ghosts? That is known as Pepper's Ghost. Behind that lies a very interesting story. But the question that I'm posing is, what modern device uses the same principle as Pepper's Ghost? So there you have the two questions. All right, now let me get back to the question that I asked this morning on the trivia show, where I wanted to know how it is that a submarine can use its diesel engines when it is cruising on the surface, but cannot do that underwater. I think that was a rather easy question. I hope that it was. But of course, any combustion process requires not only a fuel, which in this case would be diesel fuel, but also oxygen. And oxygen is available from atmospheric air, because that is roughly 19-20% oxygen. So while the submarine is on the surface, it can of course take in air and use the oxygen in the air to combine with the diesel fuel and basically run the propeller. However, when it has to dive, then obviously there's no oxygen available underwater. So it has to have its propellers run by some alternate form of energy. That alternate form of energy essentially is electricity. And that electricity is coming from batteries, and the batteries are recharged every time that this sub surfaces, because the diesel engines will not only propel the sub forward, they will also generate energy to drive the turbine that will produce electricity that will then replenish the batteries. So all submarines worked on that basis until the advent of nuclear-powered submarines. And nuclear-powered submarines, you're looking at a totally different system where a nuclear reaction based on uranium-235 generates heat, and that heat is used to boil water, turn that into steam. It is the steam that then runs the turbine, and the turbine propels the vehicle, and of course also will power the generator that creates electricity. These nuclear powered submarines do not need to surface. They can be underwater sometimes for months. I mean, obviously, that's a very challenging business for the crew to be isolated underwater for such long periods of time, but it can be done. During the Second World War, submarines had to stay on the surface most of the time because they couldn't stay underwater very long, subsisting on the batteries. So the idea was to locate a target, which was usually a ship that they would torpedo while the sub was still on the surface, and then dive down before the torpedoes would be launched. Now, of course, every time that the sub was on the surface, it could be very easily seen from the air by aircraft. So the submarine captains always had this war that they had to wage between staying on the surface and going underneath the water. And the reason that, you know, this came to my mind now to talk about this is because of the tragic episode of the Indonesian submarine. This was not a nuclear-powered submarine, so it could not stay down for, you know, a very, very long time. It was a traditional type of submarine. And it isn't clear exactly, you know, what happened, but of course signals were lost from the submarine. It was assumed to have sunk, probably due to some sort of accident that happened on board. And it sank in a part of the ocean that was much, much too deep for any kind of recovery effort. And the tragic situation here is that the crew, of course, would run out of oxygen. So the question is, how is oxygen produced on the submarine? The traditional way of producing oxygen on the submarine is through the process of electrolysis, passing electric current through water. And of course, that electric current is generated by the batteries. And the water is broken down into hydrogen and oxygen. And the oxygen is used for breathing. The hydrogen would be vented out into the ocean. And this is the classic way that oxygen is supplied on submarines. There, of course, are emergency backup systems. There are always some cylinders of compressed oxygen that are stored, but you know, that would only sustain the men aboard the submarine for a very short period of time. Then there are the emergency canisters, which are basically the same kind of canisters that are used on airplanes. You know, you may have asked yourself the question, what happens when the mask drops down? Where does the oxygen come from? The oxygen is not actually stored in compressed oxygen cylinders on the airplane. That would be a dangerous thing to do. But tugging on that mask basically triggers a little percussion cap that starts a chemical reaction in a canister to which the mask is connected, which is some in a remote place in the airplane. And that canister contains sodium chlorate and a catalyst, manganese dioxide, and iron powder. And when the percussion cap is triggered, it generates a little explosion that causes the iron powder to start to combust. That produces a great deal of heat, and that heat will break the sodium chlorate down to sodium chloride and oxygen. And each of these canisters can produce oxygen for something like 10 to 15 minutes, which is all that would be needed in an emergency. So that's how submarines work. And chances are that if there was some sort of accident that allowed the submarine to sink, the men would then unfortunately perish from not having enough oxygen. And that is really a terrible way to go, because if you just try to hold your breath and see what that feels like, and imagine that you couldn't open your mouth and take another breath. I mean, it's just a horrific kind of situation. Obviously, there have been other submarine accidents before, quite a number of them. Because, as I've described, submarine is a very complex machine. There's a lot of chemical reactions that have to go right in order to make its voyages possible. And they did find some oil slicks, I think, on the surface where they believe that this submarine sank. And there's also the possibility that perhaps somehow there was a leak that developed, and from extreme pressure underwater, and that the hull of the submarine actually somehow became compromised, and water just flooded in. Chances are that we'll never find out what happened, because the submarine is in a part of the ocean where it's just too deep to access. The other sort of oxygen tragedy that that happened yesterday was in this hospital in Iraq. And there too, it's not really clear what happened, but apparently some oxygen cylinders burst, and hospitals, of course, have oxygen all the time, especially these days with COVID, because you need oxygen to breathe. And some of the oxygen somehow leaked out, and there was a fire, and this turned into a huge inferno where over 80 people died. And here too, we don't quite yet know what happened. It's not oxygen that burns. Oxygen is not combustible. Oxygen just helps fuel a fire. So there has to be a fire in the first place. So we will find out what happened. Anyway, you're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We're going to check what traffic is all about and be right back.
Life's everyday mystery solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There is not much updating to do about COVID this week. Obviously, the world isn't doing that well. We have these horrific stories out of India, Ontario, terrible. And we're here in Quebec a little bit better than Ontario. Of course, there's still the concern that some people have about the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. And there are some theories now that have emerged about how these blood clots may occur. Again, let me remind you that the occurrence, the incidence of these is extremely, extremely, extremely rare. We're talking about, you know, a couple of handful of cases out of millions and millions and millions of people who have been vaccinated. But some theories are emerging about how, in the case of the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, some cells called B cells that produce massive amounts of antibodies against something called platelet factor 4 protein may be the cause. But again, there's no real good scientific evidence here. Also, there has been a suggestion that EDTA, ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid, which is used as a preservative in the AstraZeneca vaccine, may be responsible, but that one is not used in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Again, if it were me, I would not refuse to take the AstraZeneca vaccine, because I think taking any vaccine is better than not taking a vaccine, given the situation with which we are coping. And we certainly can look to the data that we are continuing to receive from Israel, where now going on to 70% of the population being vaccinated, and the hospitalizations have dropped to almost zero. And it would be great if we could press on and get up to 70% here as well. But unfortunately, we still have a large degree of hesitancy here, which I think really comes from just an inappropriate understanding of a risk-benefit analysis. Anyway, I think Greg may have an answer to one of the questions that I asked. Greg, are you there?
I am.
What say you?
Okay, so I was assuming that when submarines went down to periscope depth, that they had the ability to draw in air from
Yes, they
the surface.
Do. They do. That's true. I mean, during the Second World War, submarines would often cruise at periscope depth, and they would have a special snorkel that sucked in air from the outside.
Providing air for the diesel engines while charging the batteries.
Yes.
But of course, a lot of people don't understand when charged the batteries, they were lead acid batteries, and they would give off hydrogen.
This is correct. That's right.
This,
I mean, which
this,
is of course
is
combustible.
Crew,
that's a
right?
problem. Yeah, yeah.
But
the problem with cruising at snorkel depth during the war was that the submarine could still be seen from the air at that depth.
Yes, because they would look for that periscope.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I don't think I'd want to spend any significant time on a submarine.
I agree with you.
Even though I don't suffer from claustrophobia, but I think that would be challenging.
Dr. Joe, my brother-in-law, you know, been married to my sister for like 30 years. He went to sub school, and he did the training. He did the training at the submarine school, and I don't know where, but he went down for like 5 weeks. And he couldn't handle it, so he was out. So he did something else in the Navy. He's a reactor mechanic.
And yeah, I can imagine that. And of course, you know,
not for everybody.
Yeah, staying on the space station is basically the same as being on a submarine, because you are in an enclosed environment where you know everything has to be recycled inside. And yet, you know, astronauts have done that. I mean, Kelly did that for a year,
yes.
Right?
Correct.
Unbelievable.
Correct.
For a year. And others certainly have done 6 month stints in the space station. And there are people who, you know, can be trained to handle this. But I think it takes a special kind of person to live.
I think if on a submarine or a space station, don't open the door.
Don't open the door. Well, of course, on a submarine, you couldn't open the door anyway because
too
of the pressure.
Too much pressure.
The pressure. Unless you were pulling it in. You could open it.
In is good, but don't open it. Yeah. Try to open it out. Hey,
but, you know, these days, of course, you know, there's so much interest in going to Mars, right? Because we hear so much about Perseverance, the rover, and all. And, you know, it's exciting stuff. But going to Mars is not like going to the moon, which is, you know, 3 days there and 3 days back.
Oh, no, it's many, many moons later.
Many months. Going to Mars means 9 months there, 9 months to come back. Of course, you want to spend a little bit of time there. So you're talking about 2 years in a totally shut-in environment, right? That is going to be quite a challenge.
Oh, but, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But there's no question that there are people out there who are quite willing to do that. I mean, surprisingly, there are people who are willing to go on a one-way trip to Mars when they know that they would have no way to come back.
I don't understand that, but
I don't understand it either. But have been surveys done on that, and there are people who are willing to do it.
Hey, Dr. Joe, enjoy your show.
Okay, thank you.
Natasha, great show. Thank you very much for all the stuff you do.
Bye. All right, well, we're still looking for the answer to my question. So, okay. I just got texted in and did have the correct answer about the bananas. Yes, the gene that they're looking for is the gene that codes for the production of ethylene gas. And you know that there are many fruits and vegetables, bananas being a prime example, that ripen because they internally produce a ripening gas, and that ripening gas is ethylene. This is why you can put, you know, a ripe banana in with unripe fruit in a bag, and the fruit will ripen because of the ethylene that the banana releases. Well, ethylene is an extremely, extremely important industrial chemical because, of course, it can be turned into polyethylene by polymerizing the monomer of ethylene. And polyethylene is probably the most widely used plastic in the world. All of those plastic bags that we hear so much about are made of polyethylene. Many toys, like our hula hoops, are made of polyethylene, and all kinds of dishes, etc., made of polyethylene. A very, very useful chemical. It's great for putting insulation all around electrical wires. And indeed, the world these days probably could not properly function without polyethylene. But in order to produce polyethylene, you need ethylene. Today, the vast majority of the ethylene that is used is derived from the cracking of petroleum. Petroleum is a mixture of hydrocarbons, and some of these can be broken down to produce ethylene, which is then used to make polyethylene. It is also possible to produce ethylene from ethanol, and ethanol can be produced by fermentation of some sort of carbohydrate. It can be sugar cane, it can be corn, etc. So in theory, you can produce ethylene in that way, but not enough to meet the demands of the world. So there's always research to see how one can produce more ethylene. And one of the possibilities is to use this gene from bananas that codes for the production of ethylene, and the banana actually produces that from carbon dioxide, which of course is a pretty readily available starting material because it is present in the air. In fact, we have too much of it in the air, and that is what is giving rise to the greenhouse effect and climate change. So we'll see what comes of this, but it is indeed an interesting idea. In any case, you are listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll check CTV News and be right back.
Science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
Do you look upon the universe with wonder in your eyes? Do you tingle with attention when you're taken by surprise? If a problem should perplex you, does it put your brain in gear? Then you're ready for on the science frontier.
All right, one more question. What 19th century novelist got into a spat with scientists for promoting the idea of spontaneous human combustion in one of his works? If you know the answer to that, 514-790-0800. That's the number to call for your questions. And you can also text your questions and comments to 514-800. I think Sandy has a question. Sandy?
Yes, hi, Dr. Joe.
Hi.
Just out of curiosity, I see these commercials all the time in the States for this Prevagen. It's to increase your memory.
Yes, I think the best thing you can do about that is forget it. I've looked at all the literature on Prevagen, and they do not have any scientific studies that back up the claims.
Okay,
it's all anecdotal stuff, and
right.
They are dealing with, believe it or not, a large number of class action lawsuits. Have been brought against the company.
I'm so glad. I've been wanting to ask you that question for a while.
There really is no scientific evidence for that product.
Okay, wishful thinking.
Right. Okay. All right. So we still have our questions, right? About what modern device uses the same principle as Pepper's Ghost? That's the effect that you see in Disney's Haunted House and in other amusement parks, where it looks like you are actually seeing ghosts. But there's some modern device that is being used very, very regularly. You see it all the time. And it is using the same principle as Pepper's Ghost. Question is, what is that modern device? All right, so now that goes together with my other question about the 19th century novelist who got into a spat with scientists for promoting the idea of spontaneous human combustion in one of his works. Benjamin Franklin, really one of my favorite historical personalities for many reasons. But you know whether he ever actually carried out that experiment for which he is so famous is really unclear. Although he kept meticulous records of his experiments, there is no mention of his ever flying a kite with a key attached during a thunderstorm. He does, however, talk about such experiments being carried out in France in 1752, experiments which to him suggested the idea of a lightning rod. Surprisingly, believe it or not everybody welcomed the notion of a lightning rod. many people believe that lightning was meted out by God as a form of punishment for crimes. That's why gunpowder was often stored in churches with the belief that God would not strike his own buildings. Ha ha, but he did. As many a bell ringer learned the hard way. In the Middle Ages, church bells would be rung to disperse lightning, and many a bell tower was adorned with the Latin inscription Fulgura Frango, or I break up the lightning. They may have broken up lightning all right, but they also broke up bell ringers. Apparently, a medieval scholar actually studied this phenomenon and reported that over a 33-year period, 103 bell ringers were killed. The hazards associated with this occupation ended when lightning rods were introduced in the late 18th century. Still, not everyone was happy with the pointed rods that Franklin had introduced. King Charles III of England was miffed by Franklin's support of the American independence movement and, to spite him, decreed that lightning rods should be rounded. Amazingly, modern research has shown that they work better that way. Benjamin Franklin did much more than, quote, tear the lightning from the heavens and the scepter from the hands of tyrants, as his epitaph states. He may have been the first to show that chemical fertilizers, such as ammonium phosphate and potassium nitrate, could be used instead of manure. He noted that asparagus could produce a disturbing smell in the urine. And as everyone knows, he invented bifocals and the Franklin stove. But something that everyone does not know is that some people may have been convinced that Franklin had supernatural powers. After all, they saw him reach out with his cane over a turbulent pond and still the waters. There is a scientific explanation, of course. On a voyage to England, Franklin noted that one of the ships in the fleet sailing in front of his produced almost no wake, while the water behind the others was decidedly ruffled. When he queried the captain about this, he was given the surprising explanation that cooks on the ship must have just discarded their greasy water. Ever the experimenter, once he reached England, Franklin sought out a windswept pond and discovered that the waters were indeed calmed just by allowing a thin layer of oil to spread over the surface. In this, Franklin recognized an opportunity to express some of his famous wit. He hollowed out his walking cane, filled it with oil, which could be shaken out a few drops at a time. Whenever he came upon some disturbed waters, he could then demonstrate his powers to his companions. This was certainly a safer experiment than flying a kite in a storm, which the clever Franklin was probably not foolhardy enough to do. So now you see why I like Benjamin Franklin. Okay, let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron.
Hi there, Dr. Joe. I was just wondering, you're talking about Prevagen and no real science behind it. I want to know, a banana, it has potassium, so that's supposed to be good for you, but it's got a lot of starch and calories, supposed to be bad for you. So, you know, based on its chemical composure and your research, what do you know? Is a banana good for you or bad for you if you're taken in moderation?
Okay, it's always problematic about talking about single foods as being good for you or bad for you. You know, I'm quite comfortable about looking at someone's overall diet and making, you know, some sort of decision on whether it's good or bad. But single foods, because no single food should ever be, you know, vilified as a devil or respected as an angel. It's the overall diet that matters. Now, there's nothing wrong specifically about eating bananas at all. Bananas are quite nutritious. As you said, they are a very good source of potassium. They contain a number of other vitamins and minerals, but obviously they are quite caloric. So, you know, you have to add the calories into your overall diet. And it mostly it fits, you know. And I mean, I certainly eat bananas regularly. I like them. I don't worry about such things that some people worry about, that some of the potassium that's in the banana is potassium 41, which is radioactive. Of course, you can scare people by telling them that they're eating a radioactive material when they're eating a banana. But of course, the radioactivity there is so slight. The human body is actually more radioactive. We have potassium in our body, of course, some of which is radioactive. So if you really worry about that, you don't want to go near another person. Bananas are great. Obviously, they do have somewhat of a constipating effect. But aside from that, I see absolutely no problem not to make it a regular part of your diet.
So what is your opinion when I sort of click around on the internet and they'll say four or five foods that are bad for you or they're really good for you? Is that all nonsense?
Yeah, it is all nonsense. The thing to do when you come across those websites is to quickly click away from them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's a scientifically proven fact that's
yes.
The best thing to do, right? Okay,
I got it. All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye. Okay, let's quickly go to George.
Hey, Dr. George, great show.
Thank you.
Your question about the ghost
yes.
forest, would it be a kaleidoscope?
No, it's not a kaleidoscope. No. Kaleidoscope is, of course, an interesting device where you look in and you see all of these patterns that are produced because you have a bunch of mirrors in there. And, of course, they will reflect those little pieces of broken glass. But no, the Pepper's Ghost is quite a different effect. This is where it looks like there are actual humans, very often actors on a stage, who are interacting with a ghost. And you see both of them at the same time. And the ghost looks like a ghost because you can see through the person, through the ghost. And it's really quite an amazing phenomenon. And as I said, if you go to the haunted house in Disneyland or Walt Disney World, you'll see exactly what it's all about. It's very, very impressive. And there is a device that is very commonly used these days. And the question is, what is that device based on the same principle? So you've got something right in that there is sort of a mirror effect that is involved here, but it's not a kaleidoscope. All right, we're going to check to see once more what is going on with traffic. And after that, we'll be right back. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
We are born to do science. A baby can do it and so can you. We are born to do science. Just figuring out what's true.
All right, we have some callers waiting. Angie. Hey, Angie.
Thank you, Joel. Have a question. I'm due to get the AstraZeneca vaccine next week, and then after a week later or so, I'm due to go for a mammogram, and people are telling me to cancel because maybe the readings won't show as accurate or whatnot. So I'm not sure what to do.
Really? I've not heard that.
They're saying
what
maybe rationale
do they give for that?
Well, they're saying because maybe your nodes or whatever you're in your breasts are going to be swollen, so it won't give you an accurate reading for the doctor. So I'm not sure if I should keep my appointment or not.
I have no idea, but I will. I have friends who are oncologists. I will ask, see what they say.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. There may be something to this. I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of questions about, you know, whether or not if you've had a cortisone injection, can you still get the vaccine?
Mm-hmm.
And opinions seem to differ on that because everyone is just making guesses. Nobody really knows.
Right. Well, a few of my friends have told me this. So I'm just wondering, is it safe to go for a mammogram right after? And I know you said, you know, the AstraZeneca vaccine is okay as long as it's better. Any protection than none, but I'm still a little bit hesitant.
Yeah, I can understand the hesitancy because you read about these reports, and
right.
although of course the incidence is very, very low, you always think,
right.
well, what if it's me? You know, it may
right.
be only one in a million, but what if that one is me? So it's you know, it's the hesitancy is understandable, but I think you need to overcome it by thinking of the risk benefit analysis. Anyway, I will ask around to see if there's anything to this mammogram business.
And also, if because my husband had COVID, and how long does he have to wait to get the vaccine?
Oh, I think if you can get it, then get it.
Okay, because they're saying to wait like 3 months or so.
Why?
I'm not sure.
I don't understand why that would be. I mean, I think if
I think
if
they're saying
had
that he already has the antibodies in his body, and maybe getting the vaccine might.
I don't think so. I mean, this is something that I have discussed with people, and there seems to be no reason for that.
Okay.
I mean, certainly if you've already had the disease, it is less critical for you to get vaccinated because you do have antibodies.
Right.
But there's no reason not to get vaccinated.
Okay.
Great. Thanks. Let's go to Jason.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Joe. First time caller. Just about the Pepper's Ghost thing. Is it possible that it's the teleprompter?
It is the teleprompter. Very good. That is exactly what it is. And if you have seen how a teleprompter works, you have this glass in front of the lens of the camera, which is angled toward the speaker at roughly 45 degrees. And you have the text below projected onto this glass. So the announcer is looking at the glass and is looking into the lens and sees the reflection of the script. So they can read it. And of course, it looks like they're very smart, you know, like they're just talking off the top of their head, but they're actually reading. But from the camera lens, when you look through this glass, you don't see the script because it's only reflected forwards. And so this is the same principle as is used in Pepper's Ghost, where you have an actor who is underneath the stage to the front in what I guess we could describe, for people to understand, in what would be the orchestra pit. So you have an angle, you have a person there with a very bright light shining on them. And their image is reflected onto this glass panel that is on the stage, angled outward toward the audience. The actors are behind that angled glass. But what the audience sees is the actors, who they will see right through the glass, and they also see on the glass the reflected image of the person below. It's a bit hard to explain on radio because you really need some visual imagery with this. But it's a really neat technique, and it's an illusion. It's used in theater. It's used in amusement parks and museums. And it dates back to the 1800s, and an English scientist by the name of John Henry Pepper, who began to popularize this effect when he did a demonstration way back in 1862. And that launched, many, many other such presentations around Europe, because it was such an interesting and novel stage effect to present ghosts, on the stage. But I'll tell you one other connection that people may be familiar with, because this is very often seen in sideshows, and this is the illusion known as the girl to gorilla trick, where you have this cabinet. And a girl goes into it, and of course you see her, and all of a sudden you slowly see her changing into a gorilla. And this is the Pepper's Ghost effect, and of course it's done with a mirror and with lights shining in the in a very, very specific way. Another place where you can see this is in Universal Studios in Florida. And there's an attraction there called the Hogwarts Express attraction. And obviously it's a very popular attraction these days. And that uses the Pepper's Ghost effect. When you see guests who go to platform 934, this of course comes from the Harry Potter stories, and they seem to disappear into brick walls. And that is done with this Pepper's Ghost effect. So it's interesting, and something that was first devised in the 1800s, now it is used as a teleprompter. And the only thing that the audience sees whenever a teleprompter is being used is these glass panels. Now, when you, of course, when it's a TV production, then you don't see that at all because you're just seeing the announcer. But if you are at some sort of live event where someone is speaking, very often the president, you will see that they're at the podium, and both to his right and to his left, there are these stands which have just what looks like a piece of glass on them. And the glass is angled backwards. You don't, you certainly don't notice anything. You know, they just seem like two ordinary pieces of glass and you can see through them. But if you're standing where the speaker is, then what you see is the reflection of the script, which is underneath being reflected in this glass, and you can just be reading off of it. That's why you will see, whenever you have a speaker, and presidents, of course, are a classic example, you will see them turning side to side. And that is because, you know, they are reading from one teleprompter, and then they are turning and reading from the other teleprompter. You know, is when you know what's going on, it's very noticeable that is exactly what they are doing. So there, we've learned something, and hopefully today in the show, we learned something about submarines, a little bit about the space station, and something about the relationship between Pepper's ghost and the teleprompter, and why a gene in bananas may eventually be welcomed by the chemical industry. But we still have one question hanging, and I guess it's going to hang until next week. What 19th century novelist got into a spat with scientists for promoting the idea of spontaneous human combustion in one of his works? We'll get to that next week. I'm Joe Schwartz. You've been listening to The Dr. Joe Show. We'll be back with you, same station, same time next week. Until then, I hope all the chemistry in your life comes out just right.